Welcome to the Shame Free Zone with Veronica Monet, your friendly former sex worker and certified sexologist. The Shame Free Zone is a safe place for your questions and your secrets about all things sexual. Welcome to tonight's show. I have a very special guest. His name is Fred Burks, and I met Fred Burks at summer camp up in Oregon and had no idea who he was. Come to find out, he's got all these ties to presidents both past and current, and actually has quite a bit of insight into our government cover-ups. I was like, wow. And then find out that he's also tied into sacred sexuality. Now, we're going to do something very unusual tonight. We're not only going to be talking about government cover-ups, but we're going to talk about how that ties into sexuality. I know. It sounds like a long shot, but bear with us. I promise you that Fred is going to bring this home for us. Fred, welcome to the show.
Thanks. It's great to be here, Veronica, and to be with everyone listening.
Well, I'm very honored to have you here.
Well, thank you.
So, the first thing I want to do, of course, just remind everybody, this is a live call-in show. So if you do have any questions about the government, I mean, come on, it is an election year, and we're just a few weeks away from casting our ballots. Feel free to call in. I'm sure Fred can answer whatever questions you might have about government and sex. Am I putting you on the spot, Fred?
Oh, no, I love this stuff.
Okay. Toll free in the United States is 877-876-5227. That's 877-876-5227. And toll free in Canada is 888-815-9756. That's 888-815-9756. All right, Fred, maybe you should start us a little bit from the beginning. I know just a little sketch, kind of an outline of your life, but very interesting path that you've had. You apparently started off in some kind of a born-again Christian group.
Well, I wouldn't say I started off, and I got my dad just, you know, first was a Methodist minister, so I grew up with kind of religion, Methodist, sort of traditional liberal religion, but like many PKs, preacher's kids, I kind of rejected my father's religion and wanted to find out what's really out there, and basically I was agnostic at the time and didn't know whether God existed or not.
Okay.
And then when I was 18, I ran into this group of born-again Christians at my high school, and they blew me away because they weren't your typical, like, Bible-thumping, you know, you got to read this and accept the Word of God is totally true. They were all about really living and spreading love in their lives. And so I became part of this group, and to show you how amazing they were, I was with them for over a year and never became born-again Christian, and I never felt pressured by them to convert. They always respected, you know, they'd approach me and say, hey, Fred, I just want to check where you're at with this. And I tell them, no, I'm still not there. And they're like, okay, that's fine. Just know I love you. And if you do, I'd be thrilled. But, you know, no pressure.
That's pretty amazing, man, because I came from Pentecostal Holy Rollers. And
yes.
We couldn't even have turkey at Thanksgiving unless we could give our heart to the Lord.
Wow, are you serious? You have to actually say...
I'm dead serious.
Wow.
We had an altar call at my grandmother's funeral. It was just constant proselytizing.
Oh, yes, and I know there's a lot of that out there. And you know, you can't even have friends for some of those people who aren't born-again Christians. And
yeah.
I'm familiar with that. So I was very lucky to be in this group that literally they were born-again Christians and totally believed in the Bible and all that, but didn't pressure me. And I became actually one of the leaders of this group, even though I wasn't born again.
Wow.
Yeah, one of the main leaders, and they really respected me because they knew I was all about love. And from the time I was a kid, even though I didn't agree with some of my dad's politics or religion, I knew that it was about love and that Jesus Christ was this cool dude who was, like, really into spreading love and enlightening people. So anyway, I had a great time in this group, and then what happened is I went away to college, and I had to leave these wonderful friends in my life and met this, you know, so I sort of naturally wanted to find another group of born-again Christians who were like this. Well, guess what? In college, they were not like that at all. And so when I started, like, hanging out with them, like, getting all this pressure, suddenly become born again, I'm like, oh, man, and I so missed my wonderful friends back home, and I was having, you know, these were good people, but they were so pressuring me. It was like, ugh. So I basically went into this big spiritual crisis.
And this was at age 19?
Yes, it was 18 and 19. I was just almost 19.
Okay.
And that's when I got to a point where for the first time in my life I said, all right, God, if you're there, I ask you to show yourself to me. And I had never done that before because I was kind of scientific background and also somewhat arrogant. And if God was out there, I was going to find him myself.
Okay.
So it was a big deal for me to actually put out a prayer for the first time. God, if you're there, show yourself to me. And long story short, I got this book called Life After Life, which talks about people's near-death experiences and had many other magical things happen.
Oh, no. Fred, you can't just gloss over that. What kind of magical things?
Okay, well, I don't know. I mean, people probably have heard the term near-death experiences. But there was this guy named Raymond Moody, who was the first well-known doctor, who started researching all these people who have been declared clinically dead and come back to life.
Right.
From all these different religious backgrounds, even different religions, different denominations, and they had amazingly similar experiences.
True. But had you had a near-death experience?
No, I had not.
Okay.
But I came from a scientific background. I always thought I would be a scientist.
Right.
And two of my brothers and sisters are scientists. So anyway, when I read this book by an MD who carefully researched everything, it was to me beyond doubt that when you die, you go to this place, and there was very clear that it wasn't about, Jesus or Muhammad or any of that stuff. There was this being of light, which Christians sometimes interpreted as Jesus, and Buddhists would interpret as Buddha or whatever, but it was this incredible loving light that they met, among many other things. And that convinced me that there was a divine, for lack of a better word, and that there was this whole different spiritual reality that I didn't know about before.
Now, when you asked God to show him or herself, did you have any miraculous occurrences?
Well, that's actually, for me, it was that book was a miracle, because that was within probably, I'm going to guess, a month or two of when I put out that call. I got that book given to me by a wonderful friend, and then I also, a couple months later, read this book called Cosmic Consciousness, which was actually written in 1901, and it talked about how consciousness on the planet was expanding, and I had some wild things happen. Just as I was reading that book, it's like the top of my head just opened up, my kind of crown chakra opened up, and all this information just started pouring into me.
Hmm.
And it's like, wow, and it's like suddenly for me, just all these things started making sense that never did before, and I was literally crying with tears as I had this huge download of information that was just powerful and really set me on a solid, clear path, spiritual path.
Wow. Have you heard the book Fire in the Brain?
No, I haven't.
It's written by a man by the name of Ron Siegel. I own the book, but he's got an explanation for all of those. Every paranormal, past life, near-death experience ever. So there actually are some scientists out there who think they can pretty much reduce it to a mixture of cocktails and dying neurons.
Oh, yeah. Oh, I definitely know that, if you solidly believe that there is nothing paranormal, you can find all these sort of evidence to prove that you're right.
Yeah.
And if you believe that the psychic is totally real, you can also find all this evidence to support that, even scientific evidence.
I don't know, though, man. See, I've actually, had some pretty powerful connections myself through prayer.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't see how they're going to explain my seeing shooting stars at certain particular times.
Oh, I agree. And I guarantee they will find something.
They say I hallucinated it.
Like born-again Christians, the ones who are really adamant, they can find quotes all over the Bible to support them. And you can find opposing quotes, but they'll say, no, those don't matter. It's this one that matters.
Yeah.
People who are really stuck in their beliefs are not likely to change.
Well, for my money, miracles aren't just for the Old Testament. They still happen.
Oh, absolutely. I've had miracles in my life.
So did you stay a Christian?
Well, no, see, I never really became a born-again Christian.
Okay.
Even though I was, like, one of the leaders of this group, I went straight sort of into this spiritual path.
But you stopped being agnostic.
Oh, yes, definitely. I became very spiritual.
Okay.
But my spirituality was about that, hey, we're all spiritual, all in our core divine, and every one of us has a heart that just wants to love and be loved. That's basically my spirituality. I mean, of course, there's much more to it than that, but that's the basis. And one of the key things is I've always had this deepest intention of wanting to do what's best for all beings. And that's sort of always been my guiding force, and ever particularly since then, even before then. I was like, you know, if there is a divine, all I want is what's best for all of us. And so because of that, I've been led to many amazing things that I never expected. For instance, I never even thought of becoming an interpreter. And basically, I went to college. I got sick of college. I heard about this program that sends people overseas to get a powerful cultural experience. And I said, that sounds great. So I went. I lived in Indonesia, had a fantastic experience, actually living with a Muslim family there. And they were very pious, wonderful Muslims, 20 people living under one roof. And so it was one of those sink or swim situations where I learned Indonesian pretty quickly.
So you were over there on a spiritual quest?
No, I was actually over there on a program for college students. It's a cultural exchange program where you live with a family and you teach English. I was teaching English to doctors and nurses in Indonesia.
Kind of inadvertently got exposed to Muslim religion even.
Well, yeah, Indonesia's main religion is Islam, Muslim religion.
So what did you think of that religion?
Oh, well, see, the thing is, I live with this wonderfully pious family, just like I was with this great group of born-agains who are
really
non-typical. These were very wonderful Muslims, so warm-hearted, and my mother there was a total saint. Everybody loved her, just this warm, loving, giving person. So I got introduced to the very best of Islam, too, and I have a lot of respect for the religion. And like most religions, I think there are places where they're really stuck, but in their core, I think all religions have some key, beautiful truths, for lack of a better word.
Very interesting. So, before we talk about the government, how do you resolve some of the conflicts that a lot of people feel like sexuality and spirituality don't really jive with each other? They feel like they're kind of in conflict with each other. You are finding a lot to appreciate in some pretty mainstream religions. What about sex?
Well, I have to say that I think, sadly, most religions really downplay or even make sexuality negative. You know, there's all this stuff about, you know, if you can avoid it, that's better. And, you know, a lot of the sort of Eastern traditions, oh, it's better to be celibate. And I have to say, though I respect people to make that choice, I have found, and among my friends, that those who choose to go consciously into sexuality and use it as a vehicle for deeper connection with ourselves and with the divine, it's amazing transformations can happen. And I've experienced that personally in my own life.
And you got involved with the Tantra community. You went to a Deborah Annapol conference and had some type of a sexual awakening?
Well, yeah, well, it was an awakening to a whole different aspect of sexuality. I was always pretty open sexually from a pretty young age.
How is that possible since you had a Methodist preacher for a dad?
You know, my dad was a very liberal Methodist.
Oh.
He actually went to jail several times protesting against the government.
Oh, I see.
You know, you got to understand that the Methodists, like in the southern part of the United States, do tend to be almost sort of fire and brimstone. But Methodists on the West Coast tend to be much more liberal. And, you know, he and several of his minister friends would get thrown in jail together for protesting against the government, against the war, and all that.
Wow.
Yes, but I had a very, in fact, my dad was, most people call him not just liberal, but radical.
I always say radical.
Yeah. I grew up with a radical father. I kind of rebelled against that. He was too radical for me.
Huh?
And it's interesting how I've become more like my dad in my older years. I'm not really radical, but I'm very progressive.
Okay. I don't know. I've met you. I'm thinking somewhere between progressive and radical, but okay.
Right. So
it's a very unusual background in religion here. So what do you think that, it seems to me like people would love to find this loving, accepting, non-judgmental religious groups that you have found, but you think it's just individuals that you ran into? Or?
Well, no, I think there are actually groups like that out there. There are not a lot, but if you really look for it, you can find them. I know people of my friends that, like, they'll move into a new community, a new city. They will check out all the sort of churches and religious groups. And if you check them all, you'll find that some are much more really moving from a place of love than from doctrine. What you find is the ones who are really tied to the doctrine, and the Bible is every word in there is the holy word of God, and you must do this, and you must follow all these rules. they're pretty tight and don't allow you to be and blossom who you are. But within any religion and any denomination, I think you can find groups that are much more about, hey, look, it's about the brotherhood of humanity, or sisterhood, whatever you want to call it. It's about all of us connecting and finding ways to love each other more. And it's not about making them evil and us good.
Right.
And when you can find groups like that, then, you know, those are the groups you want to hang out with.
Well, you found sacred sexuality through this conference that Deborah Annapol, which for those listeners who don't know, is a huge, huge icon in the world of Tantra.
Right.
What happened there? You had some kind of an awakening?
Yeah, well, basically, that was many years later. 19 is when I went, age 19, when I went through that big shift and got onto a spiritual path. And it was, I think I was 40 years old. Yeah, 1998. I'm now 50.
Okay.
So when I was 40 in 1998, a personal friend of mine, who was a tantrika, we're getting to be good friends, and she was really sort of challenging me in ways that I liked about my judgments of the tantra community.
And you had judgments of what kind about the tantra community?
Well, my judgments were that the people that I had met who were into tantra and tantra leaders came from pretty wounded backgrounds. And were, in my opinion at the time, my judgments, I should say, were not that healthy, that they were kind of messed up and whatever, whatever.
Oh, so what do you mean by wounded?
Most of them had been sexually abused. And
oh, really?
Gone through, yeah, and just so you know, now that I'm very involved in the tantra community and even somewhat of a leader there, I still find that that's true, that I find that the majority of people in the tantra, particularly women, but men even, a lot of them have had sexual abuse histories, yet now I've learned, and I learned at that conference, they have transformed them very powerfully and actually used that to create powerful transformations, not only in their own lives, but in the lives of the people that they touch.
Of course, it's not difficult to run into incest and rape survivors, you know.
Absolutely, yes. Unfortunately,
it's just statistical averages are like 1 in 5 boys and 1 in 5 girls are sexually abused. But those are just the ones that are reported.
That's right. In fact, I've seen more like 1 in 3 women and 1 in 6 or 7 men. But I think you're right that it's actually much more than that that doesn't get reported.
Yeah, unfortunately. I personally think that's what happens when you try to suppress our natural sex drive.
Absolutely.
It comes out in some pretty nasty ways.
Absolutely. Right. And so, you know, I had these heavy judgments of the tantra community, but when I went to this conference, I was just blown away. It was kind of like being back among these people who are really dedicated to love, but in this most powerful way, embracing their sexuality fully. Yes, they had been through some difficult experiences, you said, as many have, but boy, they were just like running energy, and a few individuals in particular that I connected with just were like, whew, running their energy so beautifully and magically that it was affecting everybody in the conference. It turned me on, and I started getting involved in ways that I never expected and started leading events even right at that weekend that were very transformational and actually, as a result of that, helped to become one of the main founders of a new community that grew out of that conference.
Wow.
A sacred sexuality community, yeah.
You had a Kundalini rising?
Yes.
What's that?
Well, basically, most of your listeners probably know, but some don't, that Kundalini is kind of considered the name for the sacred sexual energy that is said to reside in the sacrum, but then occasionally rises up and causes expansion of awareness and expansion of energy in the body.
Don't they liken that to a snake coiled up at the base of your spine?
Exactly. In fact, the caduceus, which is the symbol of the medical community, has two snakes intertwined with their heads meeting at the top.
Oh, my God.
Think of that medical symbol. And that is actually said to be the Kundalini energy is like two snakes winding up the spine and at the top coming together. So that is a symbol for the Kundalini energy.
Which makes you wonder what the medical professional was thinking about when they did that, huh?
If you go back and read ancient medicine, you'll see that it's been distorted quite a bit by Western medicine.
Wow.
Yes.
So maybe the ancient healers knew that sexual energy was really...
Absolutely. Yes, and it has become so repressed. And yet the crazy thing is, you know, it's so repressed in our society, and yet it's all over the advertisement.
Oh, yeah.
It's what I call, you know, the advertisements are filled with what I call invitations to empty sex.
Ha-ha! You know what I call it?
What?
Sexual violence.
Oh, okay.
But I always tell people, well, I've been in the sex industry for 20 years. I don't see any sex in your media. What I see is a lot of violence.
That's right. It's
been sexualized.
Right, and it's all this fantasy projection and all this stuff, and it's nothing about the meaningful sexual connection that you and I know can happen when people open to that.
No, most of it's not about sexual connection at all, if you ask me. It's about how you can feel insecure and go buy my product.
Right, that's what the advertisements are all about.
How you can feel bad about yourself. I'm all about how do I feel. If I open up your magazine or turn on, you know, the program, and all you do is make me feel really horrible about myself and life, then
yep.
I don't see how sex, I thought that felt good.
Right. Well, as you know, the mainstream media is all about sensationalism these days and, you know, getting people scared and into all this violence and stuff. Thankfully, there's more and more inspirational programming coming up, but it's still far in the minority compared to other things in the mainstream media.
True. And that kind of ties into, you know, we're going to come back to the Kundalini rising, so let's hold off on that for a minute and tell us, because somewhere along the line, while you're having this sexual awakening, if you will, you started working for the government.
Well, yeah, I actually started working for the government back in 86.
Okay, so beforehand.
8 years old, yeah. And that was as a result of going to Indonesia. When I came back, I was pretty fluent in the Indonesian language, and a friend of mine said, hey, you should apply for this program where you have to take foreign dignitaries around on study tours of the country as an interpreter. I said, hey, that sounds pretty cool. So I applied, got the job, and ended up, you know, working as a contractor with the State Department, taking around these really cool people from around the world, around the U.S., and learning about various topics. It was a fantastic job. But then gradually, I ended up moving up the ranks without even trying. I actually was really good right at the beginning. I knew if I wanted to try, I could move up the ranks, but I didn't. I decided I was much more interested in spirituality even back then, so I was like, I didn't want to focus on interpreting. That was going to be kind of like a great, interesting part of my life that brought me income, but back home I was more interested in spirituality, and so I wasn't focusing on language. But anyway, some small miracles happened, and I ended up moving up the ranks, and in 1995, for the first time I found myself... Well, the first time was at a conference in Copenhagen interpreting for Al Gore, and then later that year in the White House interpreting for Bill Clinton and his staff when the president of Indonesia came.
And then eventually you continued on with this, and you were also interpreting for George Bush.
Right, yeah, so eventually I became the number one Indonesian interpreter at the State Department. And in fact, the first time interpreted for George W. Bush was 8 days after 9/11 in the White House.
Wow.
And it was quite fascinating.
Well, how so?
Oh, just, you can imagine, like 8 days after 9/11. You remember what the situation was like then.
It must have been really a lot of security.
Oh, my goodness. And yet, I'll tell you, I could have brought a gun in there.
Really?
Like, this is nuts. Yes. And it's like, they don't know who I am. Like I said, my dad was a radical, had been put in jail, and I could have brought a gun in there. But anyway, it looked like the security was way over the top, and yet the truth is, you know...
That it wasn't.
Yeah, but, it's all about looks, and this is what people in government know at the top levels of government. If you make it look this way, people believe it's this way, even if it's not.
Wow.
You know, that's a big part of what goes, and that's what advertising is all about. They realize it's not about what's really true, it's about what they get you to believe is true.
Did you get to interact with Al Gore or... President Clinton or Bush?
You know, I had little interaction with Clinton, virtually nothing.
Okay.
But with George W. Bush, I did have some interesting interactions.
Like what?
Oh, let's see. I guess I can tell you the...
I guess you got to be careful, don't you?
No, I don't. Actually, they never swore me to secrecy. That's another crazy thing. And the reason I quit was they went from no secrecy agreement to wanting me to swear that I could never talk about anything. And so that's why I actually resigned in 2004 from the State Department. They had a new contract that said no interpreter can talk about anything they see, hear, or do without written permission of their supervisor unless it's become public knowledge.
Yeah, and you quit kind of amid a little bit of a scandal, huh? I mean, it wound up in the papers and stuff.
Well, once I quit, I then became a whistleblower because I decided that some of the things which I had seen were clearly not supportive of our country or the citizens in this country or the world for that matter.
Uh-huh.
And so therefore I actually contacted some newspapers and ended up in the end, ended up on the front page of the Wall Street Journal for a
while. Wow.
So, yeah. It's,
and you're still alive.
Well, yeah. Even my own dad, who, as I've told you, is a radical, said, Fred, I don't think you should go. I had went and testified against the U.S. government in this international terrorism trial.
Wow.
And I said, look, I'm not worried about it. You know, for one thing, I've never been afraid of death. Like, the near-death experiences, like, I look forward to death. Not like I want to rush it, but I'm not afraid of it.
Yeah.
So I had a great time. When I went to Indonesia, I went to Indonesia to testify, and like I said, in this international terrorism trial, I became like the Wall Street Journal said rock star status. And it was really true. I'd go walking down the streets, and they'd go, oh, look, there he is. And, you
wow.
know, at the airport, going home, changing my money, said, you're Fred Brooks, aren't you? So it was fun for only 1 week to have that sort of rock star status. And then get home and be anonymous again, which is what I much prefer.
Okay. I don't know how anonymous you are. I've seen your name all over the Internet. So.
Yeah, in the Internet, in my field, I am quite well known in revealing cover-ups.
Yeah. What kind of cover-ups are you revealing?
Well, there's a lot. I mean, if people are interested, the website that's become really popular is called wanttoknow.info. Like, want to know, as in I want to know, WANTTOKNOW .info, not .com or .org.
Okay.
And there, this website specializes in reliable, verifiable information that anybody can confirm themselves with the links we provide about some major stuff that's going on that very few people are aware of. And they get into some pretty wild topics. And I don't know how much I want to go into that on this.
Well, how about just one?
Oh, let's see. What's an interesting one? Okay, how about the health? I'll tell you, in health, many people may know the New England Journal of Medicine is arguably the most prestigious medical journal in our country.
Uh-huh.
And the former editor-in-chief of the New England Journal let out this little piece, where I'll read the quote for you. The combined profits for the 10 drug companies in the Fortune 500 were more than the profits for all the other 490 businesses put together in 2002. And what she's saying is that the drug industry is way out of hand. They have so much money and clout that basically they control Congress, they control the government, and it's all a sham. And she goes on, and we have this quote, and you can, you know, verify all this stuff, that she's the former editor-in-chief. We have the link. And she has like a 10-page essay that just lays it out how the drug companies are manipulating the entire population and how it actually is detrimental to our health.
Oh, you know, I actually recently blogged about how I, you know, we've got the so-called war on drugs, right?
Mm-hmm.
They're busting into citizens' homes unannounced.
Yep.
With SWAT teams, killing people. I mean, the one that had really enraged me was when they shot the finger off of this little toddler whose mother was holding him and killed his mother.
Wow.
While he was in her arms.
Oh, it's crazy. I mean,
and meanwhile, I can't even get through 5 minutes of CNN without getting constantly barraged by the biggest drug pusher of all.
Who's that?
Well, Pfizer.
Oh, okay, right.
I mean, you know, I would say, I mean, who's pushing drugs here?
Well, it's the big drug companies, yeah, and it's there's a lot of craziness, but that's just one of the things. For instance, on war. We have this one of the most highly decorated generals in the U.S. Army ever has come out and said basically that he wrote this book called War is a Racket. And let's see if I can find a good quote. Here's one quote from him. The normal yearly profits of a business concern in the U.S. are 6 to 12%, but wartime profits, that is another matter. 60, 100, 300, even 1,800% profits, the sky is the limit.
Wow.
And, you know, people are slowly starting to become more aware now that it's the war machine also that has incredible control over Congress and over our government. And it's not, one person a vote, as many people know. It's a dollar a vote in this country, much more than a person a vote.
Oh, it's really gotten bad now because we've got the prison industrial complex become
yes.
a commercial enterprise.
Yes, that's the
big one. And then, Blackwater,
mm-hmm.
and you know we're turning soldiers into employees.
Oh yeah, and you know these soldiers go up and get messed up mentally, and then they come back and they're expected to fit back into society when they've been killing people in immoral ways, in order to kill people in immoral ways.
Yeah.
And, you know, the number of suicides is way up among vets and all that sort of stuff.
Wow.
So anyway, that's only just some of the more lighter ones. If you want to get into, like, official government mind control programs and how they've done weird, weird things to people with mind control, and some of that involves sexuality.
It involves sexuality.
Oh, yes. They would take people and use... I don't know how much we want to go into this, because that's a whole other program. I've actually talked about another show on BBS, but...
Well, tease us, because we're referring people to your website. They can do more research over there.
Well, there's this program called MKUltra, where basically they would create super spies, which is they could brainwash people... Oh, not brainwash them. They could turn them into multiple personality disorders, where there's a normal personality, and... then they would create these alter personalities. And one of the ways they create it was by torture and sexual abuse and various other things. And then they would become the alter personalities. One might be a thief or a murderer. Another might be an expert bomb technician. And they could switch people into alternate personality using these code words. And they could go off and do things like murder somebody. And then they would switch them back to their regular personality, and under a lie detector test, they would deny and beach the lie detector test would show it's true that they didn't kill that person.
Wow.
Because it was an alter. And this sounds way, way out there, I know, for many of your listeners, but we have government documents that discuss this stuff in detail, and you can find links to those government documents, and you can even order the CDs like I did from the CIA. The CIA sent me through their Freedom of Information Act the CDs that show that this was going on.
Are you kidding?
Right, so I'm telling you, it's pretty wild stuff. And they would use sex to seduce top world leaders with the same program. So they, you know, they particularly used a lot of country stars, these beautiful female country stars, to go and seduce foreign leaders and get them to do what they wanted.
Country singers?
Yeah. It's a long story, but...
Oh, my God, it sounds...
It's quite bizarre. It's the stuff out of movies, you know.
It really is. I was just going to say, it'd make a great movie, but I don't know if anybody would believe it.
Well, that's the thing, you know. A lot of people can't handle this information because it is pretty disgusting. But I can tell you that the thing is that this stuff has been going on, not even just for decades, but for centuries. Some of this stuff has been used. And the thing that's changing everything is the Internet now allows us to go and actually look at what's really happening. And like I say, our website, the reason it's gotten popular is because we have links to the government documents so that you can go verify what we're saying. And then once enough people know, everything starts changing. And I can tell you already things have changed big time because of the work of this website and many others that are working together to expose this stuff.
Way to go, Fred. Well, on behalf of all of us, thank you.
Well, it's exciting. That's what I'm telling you, because I work with people who are not afraid of some of the deepest, darkest stuff going on,
yeah,
and yet come from a deep spiritual base, where we understand that every being in its essence is divine, that even Hitler and Cheney in their essence are divine beings. They just had really twisted upbringings that brought them to do the things they do.
Yeah.
So we work the hardest as we can to stop the destructive behavior, stop the violence, but still not making them evil. Still saying that they were just twisted individuals, and once they can, you know, not everybody can be rehabilitated, but once they learn what's really going on and how they were being manipulated,
yeah,
things begin to change.
Did you ever meet Cheney?
I did.
What was it like?
Not very pleasant. It was only for a 15-minute thing at the White House, and he obviously was not that interested in talking to the president of Indonesia and had his typical kind of like mean, cold, closed-down demeanor, so it wasn't very pleasant. And yet, like I said, I know that, you know, if you knew his history and all stuff, and by the way, a friend of mine was his golf caddy when he was younger, and he said he was great to work for.
Really?
Yeah, and from what I've heard, a lot of these folks, like Paul Wolfowitz and Dick Cheney, when they were younger, they were much nicer, and then as they got older, they got really kind of twisted. And there's a lot.
I have a theory that if you aren't working on your spiritual blocks, at some point they will start to define you as you get older.
Yes, yeah. Well, also, the more high up you become in position and fame in the United States, in the world, the harder it is to hold your center because you have pressures from all sides. You know, there are very rich people putting pressure on people like our top world leaders all the time, you know, who are behind the scenes wanting to get it their way. And look, they've got billions of dollars behind them.
Right.
So it's not easy to be famous or politically at the top of the world.
No, I wouldn't imagine. So I'm going to just remind our listeners here, we've got Fred Burks on the line, former interpreter for the State Department, or Department of State.
Right.
Yep. Turned sacred sexuality guru. Is that what, how would you refer to yourself?
I wouldn't call myself a sacred sex. I am somebody who occasionally leads workshops in sexual energy work.
Okay, well, he's a very modest guy. His name's all over the internet. Our toll-free number, if you have some questions for Fred, we're gonna start going into just exactly what government cover-ups and sexuality have to do with each other. But if you've got any questions of your own, call toll-free in the U.S. at 877-876-5227. That's 877-876-5227. And in the U.S., or in the Canada, I'm sorry, toll-free is 888-815-9756. That's 888-815-9756. So let's get back to Kundalini rising and what you think sex can do to save the world. No.
Well, I think that's not too far off the truth.
Okay, go for it.
Let me just say first, imagine a world. I invite you and the listeners to imagine a world where everybody's intimacy and sexuality needs were basically fulfilled. Just imagine if everybody in the world, you know, all our world leaders and everything, was having a fulfilling sexual intimate life. Who would want to go to war?
Yes.
You know, and who would want to be out there cheating, ripping people each other off when, like, we're having good, satisfying relationships?
That actually worked for the Black Septemberists. Was part of the PLO.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. When they decided to retire a bunch of some of their best...
Oh, I heard about this. Yes.
Yes.
Just tell it.
They got them all married.
Yes.
and then they couldn't pay them. Bombers.
That's right. In fact, they got these really high-class, you know, sexy women to volunteer to become sort of the consorts of these guys, and most of them married them, and then
yes.
They didn't want to do the work anymore.
Yeah. No. And they didn't want to. They didn't want to kill anymore. And these
That's
are some
right.
of their best snipers, best suicide mission. I mean, these guys were almost uncontrollable.
Yes.
But as soon as they had a home, as soon
yep.
as they had somebody to love and to come home to, they were done.
Their lives changed. Yeah. And I wish I knew, you know, an URL to send people to. But if you Google that somewhere, you might just come up with it. It's a great story.
Actually, you know what, listeners, you can just email me at veronica@sexwithoutshame.com. I've got the material right here on my desk.
Right. So, and this, I honestly believe that distorted sexuality is one of the root causes of a lot of craziness in this world.
Okay. All right. So explain the government cover-up. What would distorted sexuality have to do with the government cover-ups?
Well, see... If you're frustrated in your sexuality and you've got all these power issues, which usually come out of that, then, you know, you're not getting what you want with your wife or even maybe with your whatever lovers. You know, it's like it just never is satisfying enough. Well, you go out and find power somewhere else. And so you want to find who you can screw over and feel more superior to them and make them feel shitty.
Hmm.
And I think that's what causes, you know, some people to become these really distorted politicians who are doing things that are very disempowering in the long term for everybody.
You know how our culture always talks about sex and violence?
Mm-hmm.
As if they were cousins?
Yes.
Yeah, I am of the belief that it's actually violence that is born out of a lack of sex or a perverted or a twisted or distorted sexuality.
I'm sure that it's not always true, but often true. Yeah, I think it's the lack of intimacy and sex that causes people to do really crazy things.
Yeah, it seems that way.
Well, I can tell you from the communities I'm involved in, I'm very lucky to be involved in several communities that are focused around sacred sexuality, and though people have their problems and issues, I'm telling you, compared to the normal people out on the street, it is so much more milder and more supportive than of what I've seen. And it's just exciting to be with people who really fully embrace their sexuality and are working consciously to have relationships where we talk openly not just about sexuality, and even what we specific things that we like in sexuality. You know, most people, when they make love, they do it in silence. And, you know, the woman just hopes the man knows how to touch her right, and the man thinks he's doing the right thing, but usually it's not connecting, and they're ending up frustrated in some way.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas in the sacred sexuality communities, people are really talking about exactly what they like and don't like, and being okay with that, which is a big deal in itself. And then we get to ask for what we want and to say what we don't want and work out, not even compromises, work out win-win situations for everybody involved. And when you've got a whole community, let's say a couple's having trouble, and we have this quite often, I get calls sometimes, hey, Fred, we're having trouble. Can you come mediate for us? Or they'll put out an email message to our community like, hey, anybody who wants to send some loving support? And then, of course, there's what we call sex magic, where, you know, while you're making love, you send energy to people who are having difficulty, or something like a couple friend who has cancer right now, and in the middle of making love, let's send some energy, healing energy to that guy right now.
Now, how does that work?
Well, that's just, to me, it's a belief that beneath this physical reality, the third dimensional, what you can touch, feel, taste, and smell, there's actually a whole energetic realm underneath all of that. And that every one of us is interconnected energetically. And the way I like to visualize it, all of our hearts are interconnected around the world. And there's a place in every heart that just wants to love and be loved in every heart on this planet. And when you imagine that this net or web of love around the planet, all interconnected, then we can use that energy to help support love spreading and help healing spread around the planet. And in fact, another website I manage is webofloveorg. And this has nothing to do with cover-ups and everything to do with just what I'm talking about, that we're all interconnected through love. So this is another side of my work. Go to webofloveorg, and I think you'll see some really interesting stuff there.
Well, bring it home for our listeners, if you will, though. What, I mean, you know, I'm sure nobody's going to disagree with the idea that love is a healing balm for what ails this planet. But how does love tie into sex?
Well, see, the thing is, when you're in orgasm, when you're having an orgasm or at peak sexual experiences, your energy is powerfully running. There's this ecstasy that's accessed, and we're talking about that kundalini energy. During an orgasm, the kundalini energy rises up and invigorates your entire being. And if you use that powerful passion and focus it with your mind with a specific intention, like helping to heal somebody or sending love to somebody or even sending love to the Middle East where they're having all these problems, I absolutely know that that energy has an impact. And particularly when you've got a whole community doing that together, focusing on certain things, can have a powerful impact on shifting the energy underneath what's happening in a certain place. And I can tell you stories of, like, for instance, this couple that was really known for this. Couples were having problems having babies, and they had two times where on the night that they did this sex magic of coming together during orgasm, sending love out to this couple to have a baby, within a month, these two couples both ended up having babies. And they had been infertile for, like, years.
So, do you know who isn't it Aleister Crowley?
Sure.
A lot of people associate him with the concept of sex magic.
Okay, yeah, uh-huh.
Can you... and some people actually think sex magic has something to do with satanic cults.
Well, yeah, see, that's not what I consider. I mean, yes,
yeah, so
Aleister Crowley was into
that. Give us a little bit of distinction here. So what kind of sex magic are you talking about?
Right. Okay, well, yeah, there's these kind of groups that were doing incantations and all that kind of stuff, and that's not what I'm talking about.
Some of them actually get down to, like, you know, drinking semen and things like that.
I don't know. You know, like I said, I know something about Aleister Crowley. I have not studied him. I know there are lots of groups out there that do incantations and all whatever kind of magic. And I'm not saying that's bad or good. You know, I reserve judgment about that. But what I'm talking about is something entirely different. I'm talking about groups of people that come together without any particular religious or whatever spiritual dogma behind it, and just saying, we as a community embrace our sexuality, and we want to just be clear, open, and honest, and use this energy, combining the passion with our intention, to create healing. That's the kind of magic I'm talking about. It's not like, you know, incantations and all that sort of stuff.
Okay, so how would a group of people get together? I mean, are we talking about an orgy?
Well, I mean, there's many, many different groups that do this in different ways. And I'll tell you, there's percentage-wise, there's not many. I would guess that there are on the order of thousands of groups like this in the country. But considering there's, 300 million in the country, thousands of groups is not that many.
Okay.
So, like, I have a friend, for instance, who's a member of one of the groups I'm involved in, who lives in Alabama, and she travels all the way to California because there aren't groups in Alabama that do that kind of thing. And it's just, what I call sex-positive groups.
Uh-huh.
The whole idea of sex being a wonderful, positive, supportive, loving thing is really not accepted by the vast majority of people in this country, and I would say even in the world.
But if you can, for our listeners, kind of explain what might go on at a group like this. I mean, are people going to get naked, or are we talking about tantric breathing? Or?
Well, yeah, some of the groups simply do tantric breathing, which is, sitting close to a partner, and it's not at all a lover, and it's not even necessarily a sexual per se thing. They're just sitting together, sometimes gazing into each other's eyes and breathing together and raising the energy.
And sometimes that's done fully clothed, right?
It's often done fully clothed. Some of my most powerful sexual experiences have been done fully clothed without any genital contact, without any erogenous zone contact.
Mine too.
Yeah, in fact, I so love those experiences. And I'm not putting down the orgasm and full-on sex experience, which is also quite delicious. But it's extra powerful when you're not having any sexual contact and you're able to raise this energy together and then use your intention to create wonderful things. And when you have a whole group of people doing this in a room, everybody with their clothes on, sometimes in partners, sometimes we'll sit in a circle and we'll do it. And just slow, deep breathing for like 10, 15 minutes, there's many ways you can do it, can just put you into this wonderful expanded state where you can feel and invite the energy to rise, come out through your heart, come out through your whole body, and create these wonderful miracles or magic or whatever you want to call
it. My experience of it has been that you don't even have to be. If you are in the room where that's taking place,
mm-hmm.
It can have an effect on you even if you're doing nothing.
Right.
So it is very powerful stuff. Look, you wanted to give us some how-tos and some warnings about Kundalini rising.
Oh, yeah. Since we're talking here about breath work, Kundalini rising, I'm sure some of your listeners know about it and a number don't. Basically, if you start playing with breath work in a serious way, which is where you start breathing really rapid for a long time, and it basically causes these physiological reactions through hyperventilating, it can put you into a very expanded state, but it can also kick in what's called a Kundalini rising experience, where basically the Kundalini energy, which, as we've talked about, is set to reside in the sacrum, shoots up uncontrollably through the body and can really cause problems. And so basically you want to be really careful when you're playing with breath work. Breath is very powerful, and slow, deep breath is almost always good. But when you start doing rapid breath, be very cautious and know what you're doing.
How would somebody be cautious?
Well, you'd be cautious by if you start doing rapid deep breaths for long periods of time,
yes.
You can start altering your body chemistry and it can cause problems kick in what we call a Kundalini rising experience.
Well, what is a Kundalini rising experience?
So that's when the energy is uncontrollably shooting up and you're in this expanded state, and usually when people experience a full-on Kundalini rising in the beginning, they feel like, oh my God, it's like they're making love to the universe, or they're making love to God or the goddess or whatever.
Okay.
And so it's this intensely beautiful spiritual experience, but it's uncontrollable. You can't shut it back down, and usually what ends up happening is within a day or two, the Kundalini naturally starts stimulating whatever your deepest blocks are in your psyche. So in other words, whatever your biggest issues are in your life, the Kundalini naturally is going to be drawn to that and try to get you to work on it. And what tends to happen is people then start getting really afraid. It's like, oh my God, just imagine whatever your deepest fear is.
Uh-huh.
Imagine that suddenly being stimulated. So you're going from this incredible state where you felt like you're making love to the universe to suddenly your deepest fear, like the next day or something, is being stimulated. And many people end up in psychiatric institutions.
Really?
Yeah, because of that. And I was very lucky that my first experience, I had somebody who was very experienced in this. I didn't know what Kundalini rising was when it first happened to me, and it happened like at the end of that conference I was telling you about.
And it happened through rapid breathing.
No, for me it did not. It doesn't always just happen through rapid breathing. For me, I was just in such a state of love and bliss that it just sort of naturally started kicking in. And so for some people, if you just end up in kind of and I had no drugs at all, just so people are aware, no drugs or anything. In fact, I had very little sex at that conference, too. I mean, I didn't have intercourse with anybody.
Okay.
I did have some sexual connections, but they were not that deep. But the love was just running like wild because there was all these loving people.
Okay.
And it was brand new for me, so that's what kicked in my experience.
Okay.
As I said, I was very lucky to have a woman there who was familiar with this, and she told me, you know, what to expect. She could see I was very altered, and it's like I was just in love with everybody and everything.
So it almost sounds like you were on ecstasy or something.
Right, but I wasn't, as I say. It in fact, is more powerful than that, but I was not on any drugs.
Okay. So you feel like you love everybody. You feel like you're making love to God. And then at what point did it ever turn negative for you?
Well, yes. So the next day, she warned me. She said, look, you're having a Kundalini rising experience. She sat down and explained it to me, just like I'm explaining it to you. And she said, be prepared. Sooner or later, you may have this stuff really stirred up. And sure enough, it was the next day, the second day. And Kundalini rising, full-on Kundalini rising experiences usually last from at least several days to several weeks or several months for some people.
Okay.
And I've assisted a number of people now through full-on Kundalini rising experiences. And I've had two myself. But as I said, my first one, I was very lucky. So when the next day, it was at lunchtime, I remember suddenly I started feeling it. Like from being in this totally blissful state, suddenly it's like, whoa. But she had warned me.
What does that sound effect mean? Suddenly you're in a totally blissful state, and then what?
And then it for me, it started stimulating my fears around the dark, evil forces of the planet, which was kind of my deepest fear.
Oh, so did you get paranoid then?
I got scared. But see, the thing is, she had warned me this was going to happen, so I did not get paranoid. But that's what can happen, is people get paranoid, they start freaking out, and next thing you know, they end up in a mental hospital.
Okay. All right.
But so what this woman, and I know she doesn't mind me mentioning her name, Carolina, who's a wonderful tantra teacher.
Fleischman?
Yes.
Ah! I just saw her.
Yes.
In Harbin.
She was the one who assisted me through my Kundalini Rising experience at that conference.
Oh, wonderful.
And so she, you know, helped me to sit down and ground. And basically, I knew and she knew that I had to go right into the middle of my fears. So if you try to run from this fear and get paranoid, you could easily end up in a psychiatric hospital. But if instead you're willing and you get some support and say, look, I'm going through this experience. I need people to hold space for me. And then you have to literally face your fear head on and move into it, even though it's scary as hell.
Okay.
And for about a half an hour, I was just like, whoa, this is so, it was like going down this huge, huge whirlpool into this deep, dark space.
Hmm.
But I did it. I knew I had to just go right through it. And then after a half an hour, I just popped out the other side. And this is often what people experience. If you dive into the fear and let it consume you and let it, you know, burn off whatever it needs to burn off, and that's what the Kundalini energy is doing. It wants to burn that stuff away. Boom, I popped out the other side laughing and laughing and laughing, and I just saw how I had been deluding myself with these fears, that these fears were nothing really to be afraid of.
Wow. All of this from sexual energy.
Yes, all of that from this amazing conference. It was called the Celebration of Eros Conference at Harbin Hot Spring.
So for anybody who wants to play with tantric breathing, conscious breathing on their own, would you advise them not to, that they should work with...
Don't try to have a Kundalini rising experience, I would say. You know, really, if you're going to... That shouldn't be a goal. Look it up and be really careful around that. But yes, you can use breathing to get into expanded states that are very safe and enjoyable.
How would you try to have a Kundalini rising anyway?
Oh, you can. I know people. I saw one guy bring one on. He was just doing rapid, deep breaths all day long for a couple days, and sure enough, he started going nuts.
Okay.
And, you know, everybody was telling him, you know, this is dangerous, and he said, I don't care. And believe me, he didn't end up in a psychiatric, that particular guy did not end up in a psychiatric institution, but he ended up causing some serious problems.
Wow. Who knew this stuff could be so dangerous?
Yep. But see, the thing is, I don't want people to be afraid. Breathwork is powerful. Go to Wikipedia and type in breathwork, and you'll find all sorts of great stuff.
Yeah.
When you do slow, deeper, one of the practices I do is I'll sit for anywhere from 10 minutes to an hour and just do really slow, deep breathing. It's amazing how it quiets my mind down and clears my energy, and I feel so connected and warm. And you're not going to have a Kundalini rising experience if you're doing slow, deep breathing.
Hmm.
And so breath can be very powerful. And yeah, you can play with, like, even on the Web of Love website that I just mentioned, weboflove.org, we have a simple exercise. We call it the charging breath, where for like 20 seconds to a minute, and no more than a minute, you do rapid deep breathing, and then you hold and hold your breath at the top, and instantly you just feel your consciousness open and expand. And doing it for up to a minute is safe.
Okay.
But if you start doing it 10 minutes or an hour, you're starting to play with some risky stuff.
Okay. Well, I'm going to stay away from that, Fred.
Well, actually, I actually recommend playing with it on the short term, but don't go for.
No, I'm going to stay away from 10 minutes. Or,
oh yeah, for sure.
Yeah, because I don't. That's no. Okay. I've had bad trips just on marijuana, so knowing me, I.
Right.
And, you know, I've seen demons or spirits or whatever those. I feel like I'm always just a heartbeat away from seeing the other side, so.
Mm-hmm.
I don't need to open that door.
Right.
But I definitely, conscious breathing, I agree with you, the slow stuff.
Right, well, you don't mind my sharing about our experiences at summer camp a little bit?
Well, I don't, except that we're out of time.
Oh, okay. Well, anyway, I was just going to say that you and I did some of this work with some others, so this is like slow, deep breathing, and it was really powerful.
Oh, yeah.
This group of, we had about 7 people or so, and all clothed, fully clothed.
Fully clothed, but you feel like you've had sex with each other when you're done.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing.
Because it is sex. That's the whole thing. We want to expand people's definition of sex.
Yes, absolutely.
It's not just about genitals, and it's not just about friction. It is so much bigger than that.
Oh, and it can be such a wonderful, loving experience, you know. A lot of people fall in love and then have sex, but you can actually enhance the deep, heartfelt love through, even through sexual energy, as we talked about, without any sexual contact, but then also with sexual contact. You can do the same stuff. It just takes a certain level of awareness.
Yeah, well, we're actually talking about a different kind of love, too, though, aren't we, Fred? Because we're talking about a universal love.
Absolutely.
Not a possessive, jealous, property-oriented
yes.
love, but an expansive love that is healing and inclusive.
Absolutely, and it's generally non-attached.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, when it's there, it's wonderful, and when it's not, it's not.
That's why sex can create peace.
Yes, absolutely.
But you got to know what kind of sex we're talking about.
Well, and I can tell you also that there are many more people than you might imagine, even at the top levels of government, who explore this stuff.
Oh, God. You know what? I'm sorry we're out of time, Fred. I hope you'll come back again, because I want to hear about these people.
Well, I can't give any names, but I can just tell you I know that there's a lot of people that you would never guess that look very straight-laced.
Okay, well, you do promise to come back.
Sure, I'd be happy to.
All right. All right, Fred, thank you so much.
Well, thank you. All thanks to your listeners, and thank you, Veronica.
What was the name of that website again?
Weboflove.org and wanttoknow.info.
Awesome.
And if you Google my name, Fred Burks, B-U-R-K-S, you'll find lots of fascinating.
Oh, yes, you will. Some great pictures, too.
All right,
Fred, good night.
Thanks, Veronica. You take care, and with all you guys, lots of love.
Thank you.
Bye.
Hey, this is Veronica Monet, your friendly sex worker turned sexologist, inviting you to join me every Monday night at 9 in the Shame-Free Zone for answers to all your questions about sex, dating, and relationships. Veronica Monet offers help, healing, and hope in the form of private telephone sessions. Email veronica@sexwithoutshame.com to schedule an appointment, or visit www.sexwithoutshame.com to find out what Veronica can do for you.